my goodness gracious, scorekeepers, we're back. It is time for another very spooky episode of The Score. No, it's not spooky. It's after Halloween, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, we're recording this before Halloween, so, you know, I guess it's a little spooky. As usual. As usual, I am Rocky. I am the EDI director at Minnesota Opera. I am here with my two fabulous, wonderful, beautiful, fabulous. Did I already say fabulous? I said fabulous twice. Well, you're extra fabulous. Paige and Lee. Hello, you two wonderful people. How are you both doing?
Hi. Greetings. Ladies, gentlemen, and alien superstars.
Yes.
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Exactly. To all those who are unique. I'm doing great. I'm doing good. How you doing, Lee?
Better than ever.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah. Love it.
Wow. Yeah. So what has gotten you both in such fabulous moods?
Huh, that's a great question.
Good question. Okay, yeah. Okay. You know, I'll share a little bit. You know, it's multiple things. It's multiple things. I've seen some good art lately.
Okay.
Things going well with relationships.
Okay.
In my life, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. with friends and romance and mm-hmm. business.
Okay.
And I feel just, you know, the ecosystem is healthy. It's thriving. It's
cute.
Yeah. Was able to also be, it's when you're well-resourced yourself, you can support others and show up for others. So I've been able to be there for friends in a good way recently. So, you know, that's got me feeling good. All things considered in the world, you know, it is nice to just have some moments, personal accomplishment, and feel good things. So I'm grateful for that.
Oh my goodness, you are the pure black joy. I guess we can end the show early.
Love it. Yes, joy.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, congratulations. I'm so happy to hear that everything's going so well.
Thank you.
It's a lot of good news for one human being.
I know.
I appreciate it. You know, I've been up, I've been down. Say. But right now it's an up. So, yeah.
Well, enjoy it.
Oh, I am. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'm gonna savor it.
And what about you, Lee?
Well, as everybody knows, because I know everybody knows Black history, Harlem is turning 125. Mm. And yeah. I got asked by the Chamber of Commerce to co-write an article on comic books that take place in Harlem. And it was such a delightful and fun and expected little segue from the normal, getting to a different part of my brain, an interest that I don't get to use every day over here, fighting with people about equity in classical music. So it was a really fun kind of thing to play around with. I finished that last night and it put me in a unexpectedly happy place, getting to think about some of my favorite Black Panther and Storm and Luke Cage, Misty Knight, some of those folks.
Misty
you don't
Knight.
Know who they are, get on the internet, figure out who they are. Shame on you.
Yes. I love Yet for You. That sounds so fun.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it was super, you know, super fun.
That definitely sounds like it's up your alley, in your wheelhouse. In a different sort of way than what you get to do every day, which is exciting.
Absolutely. Any chance I get to nerd out on a thing, anything. So it's always a great thing. So I woke up this morning feeling refreshed, and I also had the best sleep I've had since before seeing Edward Tulane. And, you know, Edward Tulane was lovely. It was beautiful to look at, but confession time, I have an unnatural discomfort with two things.
Mm-hmm.
talking animals. I don't know why. It just creeps me out.
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
And then like creepy dolls. And Edward had them both. So the whole time we're watching, like Damien keeps glancing at me. He's like, please don't run out of here. Please don't run out of here. I was like, well, if anything, I'll walk. I'm really not trying to make a scene at work. But yeah, I've been having nightmares for 2 weeks.
No!
But I got over it last night.
Oh, God.
Family opera, everybody. Scared to hell of me.
Oh, but... gracious. You poor thing.
Oh, man.
So when they announced the season all those months ago, you must have just been terrified.
It was like, and I can't even say anything to anybody because people would be like, oh. But yeah, so I've been holding on to that for a minute.
Oh my goodness gracious.
The whole time everyone's just been like, isn't it amazing the puppetry?
And this he's
just
so been like, fun. Yeah,
having a great time.
I can't wait to see it.
Like had loadout marked on my calendar and circled in a big red pen.
Right. Oh my goodness.
I'm just imagining you like, I just had an image of you like coming home exhausted after seeing an opera about a rabbit and needing to like turn the lights low, light candles, put on incense, take a bath, do some breathing, some breath, some meditation,
and hand exercises. I've been gripping the seat like this the entire time. I was like, oh.
I mean, it reminds me of the last horror movie I actually saw in a theater, I think was The Stranger. So what, like 2010, something like that?
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, it's like the one where like the couple, they like rent like an Airbnb and then the people in the masks come and then just terrorize them all night. It's crazy. It's crazy. But the theater was full. And so I went with like maybe like five of my friends and we all had to sit apart, and so I was sitting next to my girl Melina and I just had my face in her arm the whole time because I couldn't watch. But then afterwards we were waiting outside for the rest of our friends, and my friend Kristen comes out and her hair is just standing up on end because she had been screaming the whole time and her hair was rubbing against the back of the seat. So I just picture your hair just like pulled out.
Oh my gosh.
Screaming and terrified by this stuffed rabbit.
Well, now the world knows about my two biggest phobias, so.
We'll have to dive into that at some point. Well, I have some news that I'd like to share. Because I'm excited because I was recently invited by Vancouver Opera and the folks at Renaissance Opera up in Canada. Ooh. They're doing their Indie Fest this November, and I've been invited to go up there and lead a workshop and sit on a panel. Ooh. And I'll find the information about it, but it's called, oh, of course now I can't find it. Here we go. Holding Space, Giving Voice and Uplifting Black Voices. And we're just talking about sort of cultural erasure, urban erasures, especially in community of culture, and the state of Black opera and performance in North America. And I'll be on this panel with Vancouver's Queen of Soul, Dawn Pemberton, and Toronto-based queer interdisciplinary artist Morgan Page Melbourne. And so I'm super excited about that. So if you are in Vancouver the weekend of November 19th, come on out. And you know, we're going to be in Hogan's Alley. Celebrating the revitalization of that neighborhood, and there's going to be food and music, and it's going to be a good time. So everybody should come out.
Wow. They got the right one for that. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Congrats.
I do what I can.
And tell Dawn Pemberton I love her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Say Something was a great album. Y'all should go and pick that up.
Say Something.
Say Something.
But yeah, so I mean, that's super exciting. But we've got a jam-packed show for you today. Oh my goodness, we're going to talk about some of the wild things that have been happening on the great Poitway up in New York City. And we have a very special guest, Canadian soprano Othley Graham is on the show today. Woo-hoo, super excited. Yay. And then, of course, Pure Black Joy. So stay tuned for all of that. And we will see you in a second. All right, and we are back, everyone. Please excuse my meowing cat, if you can hear that. But we have a fantastic show for you today and a fantastic conversation that we are super excited to have. If you have been paying attention at all recently in the last few weeks, months, well, recently, this fall, Broadway kind of exploded. I don't know if you're aware, if you've been reading Vulture. But yeah, it was wild, and there were a couple of incidents, but one we kind of wanted to get into today because I think it touches on a lot of stuff that touches us very deeply, especially about being artists in the workplace, about being people of color in the workplace, about being you know, a woman in the workplace, and disagreeing with some of the decisions that are you know, that you are being made to carry out, especially artistic decisions. And what does that, well, what I'm talking about is 1776. Not to be all sort of clandestine about it. And Sarah Porkalab, am I saying that correctly?
I think so. That's how I've been pronouncing it in my head.
Okay. And she is a member of the cast who went to New York Magazine and had quite a few things to say about the process of making that show, about the direction of that show, about a number of the choices when it came to casting the roles of that show, and of course her role in particular, and the big scene that she has at the end. And she has some pretty honest, some fearless feedback from the directors. I mean, Lee, do you want to get into some of the specifics?
Yeah, I will relay this as best I understand. So Sarah said, and let me just read it so that I can actually not sort of put words into her mouth. When we were all in the room together, there wasn't any conversation about how we marry our queer identities with these characters, which is disappointing. So that was one piece of it, right? And then she went on to talk a little bit about the presentation of race as a binary, right? And I think that's probably hard to divorce from the source material. I think there's a whole different conversation that we can and probably should have about how do you modernize works if you're going to take a radically different approach to race and or gender or and or sexual identity or orientation, especially in these pieces where it's somehow baked into the plot, right? But she talked about that specifically in terms of how people are presented as either slave owning or not in the cast. And then even more complicated, I think, for some folks, is she went on to describe that she only wants to give about 75% of herself in a performance, in a context where I think any of us who grew up specifically in the theater, right, the language is always around giving 100% of yourself, putting yourself 110%, right? Throwing yourself into performances. And, you know, I think this is why we also see, like, in films, like, people being lauded for, you know, I lost 150 pounds to play this role, like that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So that article went out, and one of the co-directors of the piece, so I think we should say the piece is co-directed by Diane Paulus and Jeffrey L. Page, and Mr. Page had a strongly worded response to Ms. Porkalab that was, I believe, posted somewhere on social media. And there, I think what we may spend some time talking about is the second version of that post where an invective was edited out, right? Because I don't want us to even for a second portray ourselves as defending or justifying that last statement, which he himself decided didn't need to stay in the comment. And sort of the brouhaha that played out in terms of how Broadway performers responded, and also in terms of how Broadway fans responded, and then the rest of the world followed suit. And maybe that can be summed up in this idea that, in my opinion, now not to put words in the mouths of my co-hosts, that we have this almost fetishized view of being a performer as this kind of, you know, like rarefied experience where you should be so grateful for the opportunity to perform that you do not have critiques to offer, right? And I don't think this is the only place where this happens, right? I think there are lots of places where we are expected to come to work and be happy and not have any commentary, especially not any public commentary. I was
gonna say, especially not a public critique.
Right. About these kinds of things. So I feel like you will see it a little bit more with film actors who may be sort of inoculated against it by their own fame, who will come out sometimes and make very critical statements about like movies they've been in or TV shows or whatever, but it's much rarer to see it from Broadway actors and opera singers. And when you do see it, it's from those people who are household names, right?
Right.
And the sort of conversation that this sparked about what does that mean, what your obligations are, and what kind of mask should you be wearing publicly to keep up the charade that everybody who is a professional performer is grateful just for the opportunity to be able to step on a stage, right? Like, I think the workplace conditions conversation and what it is to be a queer person, what it is to be a person of color, what it is to be a human being in any kind of corporatized industry, I think we should be having these conversations, right?
Oh my, like, gosh, absolutely.
You know, and I think the other piece of this, it's spilling out into lots of other areas. I won't make a long tangent about this, but in the other part of my professional life, graduate students at Columbia have been striking for quite some time, right? Mm-hmm. There's been teacher strikes here, nursing strikes here. Like, there are lots and lots of things that are happening right now, and people are very interested in having this conversation about both work-life balance and what kind of narrative we're building around who gets to be comfortable at work and who gets to talk about that. So that's some of where I'm coming from, mm-hmm, as I'm reading through this piece.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's so much to respond to. You just I feel like you almost just said it all. Like, yeah. But that last part, I mean, I didn't go to Columbia, but I've been hearing about the strikes and stuff, and like against this larger moment everywhere, people talking more about just, you know, what we deserve, that we don't deserve to be like, labor doesn't just automatically come with exploitation. Like, we don't need to, it's not like we just like accept it. We're just like, this is just part of it. Like, you have a job, you get exploited. Duh. Like, no. What? Why do we operate like that? So I'm glad that like this is coming up for theater specifically, like, and coming into the larger conversation. I think there's like a lot of messed up stuff that we endure for the sake of putting on a performance. But like, there are certain things that like you shouldn't have to perform and shouldn't have to be on about all the time. Like, people's contracts are for the performances, for the rehearsal periods. We can't do this thing of like policing how folks respond. If they have critiques, they have critiques. And especially if sometimes when things like this come out, I think, well, maybe you didn't have space for this critique to be expressed within the creative process itself. Mm-hmm. And maybe this could have been talked about. But
because that's what I kept thinking. That's what I kept thinking about as I was delving more into the story, that I'm just like, well, if this is such like a, you know, quote unquote woke production of 1776, why was there not space for all of these things that she's talking about to be brought to light? And then she is talking about other certain things in the process that were like, seemed kind of wildly problematic and hurtful and traumatic, and those things were kind of talked about at the time and then maybe talked about a little bit later, but never actually really solved. And so I think, you know, she's perfectly well within her rights to wherever she wants to just express that, to say that, like, yeah, you know, I see what the intent was, but the impact was this.
Yep.
So, you know, and of course, like, you know, we were speaking about this before we started recording. And, you know, in the great words of Erykah Badu, you know, we're artists and we're sensitive about our bleep. And so, yeah, her coworkers, the directors, all those folks are going to have feelings and they're probably going to be emotional. And that's okay. I think, you know, let's not fall into this sort of white supremacist culture trap of like, if you're expressing an emotion, then that's inherently bad or evil or problematic or scary or like, ooh, like, let's not fall into that trap. But I do think that, you know, for me, it just brings up this, it does feel exploitative. Because she says numerous times in this article that like, this is her job. This is just her job. This isn't who she is. And you know, that 75% comment, like, it's just another way of saying that, like, you know, I'm on stage, I'm giving 75% so that I have a little bit left over for my partner, for my kids, for my family, for all of the other 10,000 other things that I have going on. That is not me singing this one song in 1776. And she's allowed to say that. And like the idea that, like, you know, I feel it so much. Like in as just, you know, a person of color, a queer person in spaces, like, dare I say, sometimes in the space where I'm currently working.
You don't say.
Where it's just like, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, I'm asked a question publicly, like, for instance, you know, when we were on the Triloquy podcast and, you know, asked a question about something specific that happened here. And there's this sort of line that you want to toe where it's like, you want to, you know, be honest, but you want to also be employed. But what I'm never, ever going to do is sit here and just sort of like tap dance and be like, oh, everything's fine in the opera industry. There's no problems at all. Because then why am I here? Why are we here having this conversation if everything's fine and everything's perfect and like whatever? And people can get mad about that as much as they want. But like, that's the only way that we're actually going to like progress.
Bingo.
Do something. If we're actually like bringing these like, you know, topics to light. And like, maybe I could go a little bit harder. Maybe I could sit here and talk about like the specific people and programs and ideas that are making my life harder and making my job harder. I choose not to do that. Maybe I will someday. Know that.
It's not all out of the realm of possibility.
I mean, I'm just saying. Push me. Sagittarius season is coming up. But yeah, no, the whole thing just, you know, this backlash is just,
well,
brings up a lot of stuff for me.
There's a piece of it for me too, because I've worn the hat of performer and of director and of producer and of designer and of audience member, right? And I think one of the things as audience members we have to do is disabuse ourselves of the notion that this is something other than people working for a living. And in my day, Broadway actors made $2,034 a week. That's what the equity minimum was. Perhaps it's gone up, I hope it has, which in New York City just makes you very regular middle class, right? And
I think
if that, right? And I think the idea that someone is going to sort of sell their integrity for that amount of money is it's not a realistic one, right? And I think now being in a different place on the org chart, a lot of what I think about is, how do you construct a space where people feel like not only can they do their jobs, but they can be themselves and they can live, and that I am also showing up as a person who can hear that, right? And receive the critiques when they come, and they do come, right? And, you know, I think what makes some of this easier is in this function, I'm not like creating a piece of art that's close to my heart, because I've also been there and, you know, been a writer and an actor say this, that, and the third about what they liked, and my ability to respond to that, there would be effort, a lot of effort required for me not to take it very personally. I don't have to take spreadsheets and program designing personally in the same way I did if I'm like, you know, this is my heart on stage. But I think that there's a way that, you know, we also have to reframe for ourselves what this kind of a gig is, because some of where a lot of the very interesting critiques were coming from other Broadway actors who were also pointing out, hey, there's a team dynamic piece of this. And the minute that article came out, the dynamic of the other, you know, 18 humans that you are sharing the stage with shifted. And what is your responsibility to them, right? And I think Sarah put out some very thoughtful messages of accountability that, you know, this is not directed at my colleagues, it's not even really directed at the directors, right? I am presenting my perspectives that I have the right to own as a human. But it's a really complicated thing, and our desires to overlay this with a regular workplace experience, I think, is a problem, right? Like, this isn't as simple as a, you know, the actor works for the director, and therefore this means that like the power gradients in spaces like this are way more complicated. There are lots of instances where performers wield much more influence than directors do. And sometimes, you know, producers are going to be much more responsive to one party than another, right? That they're, it's not quite super simple as some of the tweets I was reading about what this meant, who wielded power, who should have the final word on this. I think it's a conversation that we need to have about what it is to be a professional artist in this country. How do we give people space to be people? How do we make this a livable profession? How do we make sure there's a lot of dignity? And then also in the process, how do we create a rehearsal room where people are getting to speak their truth and then it be contextualized appropriately, right? Because there are mm-hmm. a lot of times that performers are speaking their truth and it's like, great, I hear you. The other 30 people in the room don't feel this way. So now we need to take this and hold on to this and keep moving with this, right? It's a very complicated dance. And, you know, the other piece of this is we have this fascinating, valid article where Ms. Porkalab is presenting her perspectives. And there are a lot of other people who worked on this production that we don't know if this is their truth, if they would come out saying anything even remotely similar. And not that that's supposed to make her perspective more valid or not valid, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, this is the only bit of evidence we, you know, can really respond to in the moment. So, you know, there's that complication as well.
Yeah, I think the one thing that like made me, I think the only thing about Sarah's comments that made me wince just a little bit, is like, I think I understood, you know, some of what I think both of y'all have touched on, this being a team effort usually when you're creating this kind of thing and the impact that it has on other folks. And I especially just thought, man, sometimes I just be wondering what it'd be like to be non-Black and have a different kind of freedom to think, or rather not think about how things impact the Black folks in the room. Because that is one of the things that if I were in this position, if it were me, I think there's something ingrained in our culture often where it's often not even a thing I have to think about anymore. I just know to not do certain things, or I don't do certain things because I know how it impacts the bags of Black people around me, other Black people around me. Yeah. And we all just have a silent agreement amongst ourselves. We ain't even got to voice it, that whatever BS we are dealing with in this process, we will talk about it when it closes. Yeah. When it closes, then you can feel free to drag, just read whoever for Phil. But we know we're not interrupting each other's bags in this moment. I don't know what you got on going on. You don't know what I got going on. I don't know how much you need this. You don't know how much I need this. How it's going to impact the other people in your life. And so there is, you know, I think sometimes in these situations, I acknowledge a little bit of privilege, and it comes with it. It's also not lost on me that this person is queer, also because we face the same things in queer spaces as well. Black folks in Black queer folks in queer spaces, like, hey, like, I know we got marriage equality in some places, but the girls are not okay. Like, we're still not okay. Like,
oh my God.
Like, I know you got a hold of your hormones and access to healthcare, but the rest of us are still struggling, sis. Yeah. So, you know, it's just one of those things where I'd be like, dang, what's that like to not have to...
To not have to do that calculus in your brain.
Yeah.
Literally all day.
And that's the reason why I don't fly off the handle on here and start talking about people. Same. Because I don't want to mess up what the two of you have going on. And so, like, you know.
Right. Because we live with a different kind of consequence culture, I think, as Black people.
Yes.
And, you know, I was reading something on Twitter talking about a certain rapper that none of us is dealing with right now. I won't even say who it is. And there was a person responding to something saying, you know, we as a community, we do what we need to, you know, when there are these instances, we have an ability to have internal conversations, like as a very large community, right? Like people get to see it now on Black Twitter, but like this has been like a reality for us for a very long time, because we are all aware that opportunity is not a lengthy visitor. People are not guaranteed these things, and a backlash against one of us can very easily dry up opportunities for a lot of people. We've seen that happen before, right? Like there was a reason they still can't find an actual scandal from the Obama administration, because he understood going into it that, you know, I wear the wrong color suit and there will not be another Black president for 100 years, right? Like there's a very different set of rules that come into play.
And shows and, with Black people in the cast have closed for far less.
I mean, right. And so here we are, parsing our words, right? Yeah, it's a, it's not, everybody doesn't have access to even the same, you know, modalities of critique as everybody else who identifies as a person of color or identifies as a queer person. And I think, you know, I also look at these moments with like a blend of admiration, caution, confusion, envy. You know, like it's a whole mix of things, because I feel like, you know, so many things in my professional life are like such a tightrope act in terms of just being able to manage the expectations against what I actually think I need to be able to do in a given moment, just to make sure I'm not causing myself and other people who are interested in doing similar things, you know, not to be able to have an opportunity because I got too real one afternoon, right? And all it would take is once, right? I mean, we've also heard that song before. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. I want to be clear that by no means do I think like, oh, she shouldn't have said nothing.
Oh,
like,
God, no. No.
Absolutely.
No.
Light them up, girl. Go ahead. Let it. Do it. As Black folk, as folk of a deeper melanated hue, what we're saying is that we often just have to have a little bit more patience, coolness, strategy in how we address whatever's going on in our workplaces.
Yeah. The number of times I've walked out of a meeting and had to turn to another Black colleague, and the only comment we could be is, girl.
Yeah.
And like that has to substitute for literally every single other thing, because there is not going to be the space to present the critique and then to expect the door to be open to further conversation, right? Like that there really are different rules at play. And I don't think it benefits any of us to pretend like that is not the America we're living in.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, I can hear somebody, you know, out there in podcast land being like, well, as Black folks, why are you putting yourself in these spaces? Why are you subjecting yourself to this? And sometimes, like, child, I ask myself the same question. All the time.
Well, I will say one thing, because I haven't seen this production of 1776, and I do have to go to New York again next month, and if it's still running, I actually am very, very curious about it, because it's a show I've seen a couple of times. It's just kind of like, as a U.S. history buff, it's kind of a fascinating interpretation of something that absolutely seems to resist musicalization. But there is a song in the score that is one of my all-time favorite show tunes. It's called The Lees of Old Virginia. And yes, right? Great title. And the character who sings it, Richard Henry Lee, essentially says a series of of phrases that end in adverbs and emphasizes Lee every single time. And it's basically like listening to somebody sing my name for 3 minutes straight, and I really, really
Are
enjoy
you sure you're not a Leo?
it.
Do you have Leo placements? Like anyway, go ahead, Sean. I'm sorry.
I mean, that action might be the whole story.
That's it,
That's what I got.
Well, I'm sure this is a story that we will keep on following, and we will have much more to say coming up in the future. But any final thoughts before we take a quick break?
Sarah, if you are listening, email us. We'd love to have this conversation with you next
Ooh,
time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right. And with that, we will be right back.
And we're back. Okay, everybody, we have a fantastic guest with us today. I am so excited. This is a person of whom I am a huge, huge fan. So I'm so glad she was able to make time for us today. Please welcome Athalie Graham.
Yay! I'm so excited to join you all. I'm so excited. Thank you so much for having me. This is a big honor for me.
Oh,
Oh,
thank
thank
you.
you.
It's an honor for
I know,
us.
for real.
Absolutely.
I'm a fan of the show, so it's an honor for me. And
Aww.
well, all the good work you guys are doing, I mean, it's so important.
Well, let's share with the audience some of the work that you've been doing. I know they will also be very, very taken with you. Canadian soprano Athalie Graham continues to receive acclaim throughout North America and is known for her interpretation of the title roles in Turandot and Aida and her commitment to the Wagnerian repertoire. Opera News calls her a vocally secure Turandot, her gleaming tones well suited to the Ice Princess's misanthropic resolve. Upcoming, she makes her role debut singing the Foreign Princess in Rusalka with Portland Opera. Ravel's Scheherazade and Isolde's Liebestod with the Harrisburg Symphony. Recent performances include the title role in Turandot with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, the title role in Aida with Opera Carolina and Toledo Opera, and Minnie in La Fanciulla del West with the Nashville and Indianapolis Operas. Recent concert highlights include all Wagner programs in Mexico City and Peru, and with the Washington Chorus at the Kennedy Center, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Verdi's Requiem with the Atlanta and Mississippi Symphonies, Serena and Porgy and Bess with Toledo Opera, Springfield Symphony Orchestra, and Jacksonville Symphony, Isolde and Tristan und Isolde in Croatia. And with the Washington National Chorus at the Kennedy Center. So we frequently say people are singing all over the world, but she's literally singing all over the
Yes.
world. So
Oh my
thank you again for
goodness.
making time for
Nothing like a little traveling.
us. Do you have Sag placements?
So I think I'd love to just jump right in and hear a little bit about the ways that your background has shaped your identity on your career journey in opera and classical music. And I think you may be the first Canadian that we've had on the show. I think most everyone else we've spoken to has been American born, and I also think you might be the first person of Jamaican descent we've had on.
Yay! Yes.
So I'm
You
super excited to hear.
fueled by ackee and saltfish and you know, when I was a student in middle school, my teacher, you know, everyone, we don't have the same kind of choir culture in Canada as they do here in the United States with, you know, choir, big, huge choirs and competitions and that kind of thing. But our music class, our teacher wouldn't let me sing with the choir. Every time I would start to sing, she's, oh, you know, because my voice was so big that you could only hear me and not the choir. So she spoke to my parents and said, you know, I think that your daughter could be an opera singer. You know, she's very young, it's very early, but you might want to start exposing her to opera and classical music. And of course, my Jamaican father, his daughter is going to be either a lawyer or a doctor or one of those secure careers where you will absolutely, you know, have a career and a paycheck. You know, telling him that his daughter could be a musician, even though it's opera, but musician, was not his favorite thing. But, you know, Leontine Price came to Toronto to do a concert, and he saw in the newspaper and got tickets for my mother and myself, you know, thinking this would expose me to a Black singer. And I was absolutely overwhelmed. And, you know, I brought my little flowers to give to her afterward. And unbeknownst to me, I didn't know, you know, I've never been to a concert, so I didn't know how the program went. So I thought the program was over, and I raced up to the lip of the stage. Miss Price, here are my flowers. And she came to the front so gracious. And she said, sweetie, the concert's not over. And of course the audience is, you know, oh, how sweet and giggling. And, you know, and she said, but you know, why don't you stand right there and I'm going to finish. And then I'm going to come back and sing an encore. And of course, if you know, her recitals, you know, there were six encores. And I just, you know, stood there absolutely weeping and weeping. But it was when I saw Jesse Norman sing big. I mean, she was just so regal, so beautiful, and floated from the wings onto the stage, and her voice was just, you know, the size of a tank, but yet she could, you know, sing softly, and it was always beautiful. And I just said, you know, that's what I want to do. I don't know how I'm going to do that, but that's what I want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've talked about it on the podcast before. But like when I was 8 or 9, my mom also took me to go see Jesse Norman at the Kennedy Center. And I remember sitting there in the audience and just gobsmacked. Just like, wait, humans can do that? And we can do that?
Well, wait, what? And right. And that's the lesson. You know, humans can do that, but we can do that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there is where we all know how much representation really matters. I mean, it really, really matters, because no matter where you are in your, you know, in your life, you know, whether you have money, you have no money, you know, whatever, but you could look at her and say, that could be me. You know, you at least see that it's possible. You don't know how you're going to get there, but you know that that is at least possible. You know, it's like, you know, Viola Davis, you know, in her book, talking about seeing Cicely Tyson in Sounder, you know, in her, you know, rat infested apartment with her parents, where the rats are eating her doll's faces. I mean, it's so powerful to see what is possible for you. And that's why representation is one of the most important things, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So I'm curious, you know, as you started your career, you know, this incredible career, and now you're, you know, singing all over the world. Have you had mentors of color through your career that you've admired and who've helped shape the singer that you are today?
I mean, I think I haven't had as many hands-on mentors, but I do know that a lot of us in the business really reach out to each other, and people, you know, I remember being a student, and, you know, someone like Angela Brown would come to my school And, you know, she was having her coachings, you know, getting ready for Aida somewhere or, you know, Ariadne or whatever. And just, you know, sitting outside of the door and listening to that voice and watching, you know, how she navigated her career, how she carried herself through her career, but also, you know, all of us, of which, you know, we all, there's not that many of us, but we all know whom we can reach out to as a sisterhood, as a brotherhood, and say, you know, my gosh, this just happened. You know, what should I do? And, you know, looking for advice and things like that. And that is something, you know, the family aspect is something that I really appreciate. And I mean, I've had that not just with singers of color, of course, but mm-hmm. it's something that's really important. And I think I wish that I had more of that early in my career, more, you know, singers, the friends that I have now, I wish I were, you know, friends with some of them, you know, when I was in the beginning, because there were a lot of situations that I had to figure out, you know, for myself. And you don't always know what to do, whether it's vocally, whether it's, you know, with conductors, directors, colleagues, traveling, you know, so many things happen, you know, getting visas for countries, that kind of thing, that only your managers or agents, voice teachers, coaches, they can only tell you so much based on their experience. But when you have someone who is your friend who is singing or has sung the same repertoire, I mean, it's that is invaluable. You know, ooh, look, this happened to me here. You know, in this passage, this is what I had to do. You know, make sure you eat protein the morning of, because, you know, some of those roles are long and require a lot of heft and stamina. Don't eat any salad. Don't eat no salads, girl. Not today. But I think that again, that sense of family and community, you know, when we go to work, you know, hopefully it's a good experience. Usually it is. But in my repertoire, I was always the younger singer. So I was always able to watch, you know, all of these singers who've had these huge, long, incredible careers. And I would sort of just, you know, I had my own voice in rehearsals and things like that, but I wasn't as vocal, you know, as I am now, because I was just, you know, watching and learning and absorbing. And it was such a great education, because unlike a lot of my colleagues, I didn't go to undergrad music school. I went to York University as a good Jamaican daughter. and I took biology so that I could go to medical school, which didn't happen. But you know, there came a time when my teacher, you know, I was already older, and my voice teacher, Lois McDonald in Canada, you know, said to my parents, look, she's going to have to, you know, I couldn't read music. She's going to have to take, you know, take this seriously, get out of what she's doing and take some rudimentary classes in music and piano. And, you know, this is a whole note, this is a half note. You need to know all of these things. That's basic. You know, I was in basic music classes with, you know, 6-year-old kids who, you know, could already play the piano and play their instruments. But, you know, that was a really difficult shift, because my father really wanted, you know, me to have something to fall back on. And, you know, my teacher said, sometimes if you don't have a safety net, you don't fall into it because you're not going to need it. So, you know, although in the pandemic, I'm sure we all wished we were doing something else too, but, but it was, you know, it was a really fork in the road for me. And it was sort of, you know, she's already, I think I was 20 by then. And it was like, look, yes, she's a dramatic soprano. So, you know, hopefully she'll have a lot of time to get into her repertoire. But for auditions for young artist programs in schools, she has to start, you know, learning her arias and getting prepared. So, you know, much to his chagrin, I dropped out. I was a college dropout and, you know, just focused on music, thankfully. And thankfully I had her, you know, who had a huge career in England, you know, lots of recordings and things like that. And, you know, she was able to tell me, things that you wouldn't know to tell a singer unless you had a career. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. how to be with the stage hands, you know, what happens when you have to get out of a car in front of royalty or you know, meet prime ministers or things like that and have dinner with them. All of the things that you don't think about that I ended up, you know, using and needing desperately.
Wow. That is, yeah. just invaluable. Like, it's heartwarming to me and kind of tender to me to think about how I think so many artists, especially of color and especially Black artists, I hear having similar experiences of just like, you know, relying on community in some way to, mm-hmm. to, you know, to make it, to get through. Like that's just what we do. I'm curious. Then that leads me to think about like, what do you want to impart at this moment on aspiring singers, artists, musicians, whoever in opera and classical music who are considering a career? What advice do you have? Especially since you know embrace this untraditional path, like you said, not going to undergrad like mm-hmm. other like so many other folks have.
I mean, and when you don't do that, I mean, I went from my teacher's basement to the Academy of Vocal Arts. You know, everybody else had bachelor's and master's degrees. I mean, I always say basement, and it sounds terrible. You know, her studio was there, but I mean, that's exactly, and it was a beautiful space, of course. But you know, that's exactly what I did. And when I got there, you know, they were like, "Wait a minute, can you read music?" I was like, "Is there a sight singing test?" Because not really. but most, I mean, truly not really. And I auditioned. I mean, I auditioned. I'll get to the question about artists, but I auditioned in the United States. The terrible part, or the other big, you know, defining moment in my life was my father died. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to not. He died and we had nothing. I mean, it was just my mother and myself. And the three of us were so unbelievably close. And I was so desperately in love with my father. I mean, in love with my father, like you can't imagine. And the three of us, you know, we were always together. You know, my parents were young and, you know, they were already married for, you know, 26 years. They got married young and were in love and, you know, had this wonderful home life. I had the most amazing home life, which I know, you know, a lot of people can't say. So I'm always so honored that I had that. But as soon as that happened, you know, I said to my voice teacher, okay, that's it. I'm going to go to university, go back, you know, go to medical school so I can take care of my mother. You know, she's so young. My mother was 47. And, and she said, listen, the best thing you can do is continue what you're doing. And I know it's hard. And, you know, we had no money. We had nothing. And people talk about people, you know, not just the community. I mean, everyone, people rallied around and gave me, and this was a conversation I was having with someone else about how to support, you know, young Black artists in particular. And any artist who needs financial help, is that people always think, oh, I'm going to set up a GoFundMe page and people can give money for my audition tour. But there was no GoFundMe then, but what I did, let me date myself a little, but what I did was, and my teacher, who was so smart, would solicit things that she knew I would need. So air miles, people could pay for my hotel for the audition directly to the hotel. Mm-hmm. You know, some people don't want to give you their money and some people don't have liquid asset. So look, I have this credit card. I can pay for 3 days of your hotel, or I can give you, you know, this voucher for whatever. So think that's how I ended up going all over the United States, you know, for my auditions.
Wow.
And without that, I absolutely could not have done it. I could not have gone.
Mm.
And the important advice at this juncture that I would give to young artists, especially in the time of social media, run your own race. You have to be like a horse with blinders. There's a reason they put those blinders on the horses. Don't get distracted. Don't, you know, comb through other people's stuff and look what so-and-so is doing. And that is so hard. It's hard for me, you know, when your agent tells you, oh, look, you know, so-and-so just asked about you for these dates. And then you know, 6 months later, find out, you know, go to the Opera House's website and see, you know, that your colleague got the job instead of you or whatever. Mm. Don't do that. It's so hard. and I know, I say this to myself, don't do that. But I know it's difficult. And I know that we're told, especially now, that you have to cultivate your social media and a social media following and all of that kind of stuff. And I love social media. I have found it, for me, to be incredibly helpful. Mm-hmm. I've had conductors, you know, reach out and, oh, you sing this? Great, I'm going to call your agent. I just saw you were working on this aria or this opera. I saw that you sang this here. I just heard a clip of you singing this. I'm going to call your agent. Great. What is bad is when you're sitting at home, you know, in your parents' basement, let's say, and you're on social media, and it seems like every single person is in every program and every, you know, and that's just not everyone's path. It definitely was not my path. And I know people say, oh, but you went to ABA. Okay. But some of the people who went to ABA had already been to, you know, Santa Fe and Juilliard and all of these illustrious places. And that's not where I came from. I absolutely had not stood on a stage and been directed. Hmm. I mean, I knew nothing. And these people were all, no, your stage left is your other left. I'm like, oh, okay, sorry. I mean, so many things. But in doing this, you know, it's so important for us artists who are doing it to reach back and help, to give advice, which I know a lot of you know, the Black singers that I know, and other singers, not just the Black singers, the other singers of color, I know that a lot of us do this. You know, I'm open to, you know, people will send me direct messages and things like, you know, what do you think about this, or, you know, and I answer always. But people can help you in ways that you don't necessarily know or think. You know, if you do a concert at your church and someone says, you know, oh my gosh, you've got such a great voice, how can I help you? Well, I need a subscription for Yap Tracker, which is where all of the auditions and competitions are listed, but I can't afford it for the year. And it's, I don't know how much is 100 and whatever. I mean, it's not, you know, it's a lot for some people and not a lot for others, as things are in life. So little things like that are so important. But my most important advice, please run your own race.
Mm-hmm.
And you could still, the career that you want doesn't always look the way you expected it to. And that doesn't mean that you're less successful.
Yeah.
And to me, you know, that's the most important thing. Just because, you know, you're still an artist and you can still have a career, whatever that looks like for you.
Yeah. Mm. I love that. That's very powerful.
And this is great life advice.
Yeah.
And don't read the comments. Don't read the comments.
You know, it's so funny. I mean, even just something as simple as, you know, little things where someone posts an interview about you, you know, from a newspaper, and someone comments, you know, San Francisco Classical Voice did the most, like, my life definitive profile. And someone wrote something about, well, you know, what, you think there are no Black Canadians, or, you know, something. It's shocking what people write. And I always have to be so careful, as you say, not to read the darn comments, because some of them are hurtful. And as much as I act like I have this, you know, wonderful rhinoceros hide on my body, you know, some things are a little hurtful. So.
Well, while we're doling out advice, we know that there are a lot of artistic directors and other practitioners who listen to the score. And we also know that you have this extraordinary reputation for having tackled roles like Turandot and roles in the Wagnerian repertoire. And I'd love it if you could share some perspectives for them about how they may wish to approach roles in pieces like this in 2022, when we are in a very different place and representation matters as much as it does.
I think that, first of all, a lot of these operas, you know, the Turandot seems so grand. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you see that, you think grand, expensive. And it doesn't, you know, I mean, you know, you're like, oh, we should do, let's do Romeo and Juliet instead. But, you know, or some other small thing. But it doesn't have to be that way. If they, you know, you can partner with a university, let's say, you know, a higher level university's choir that has a really good choir, they could do, you know, some of the chorus, or they can fill in your smaller chorus, which I've seen a lot. Some of these houses, and I've done this often, thank goodness, it's my favorite, you know, to do Turandot in concert. You know, that is, it is no less thrilling when you do an opera in concert, because we sing in concert the way we would sing in the opera. I'm not just standing and you know, delivering texts. I am, you know, still passionately kissing my kalaf, still, you know, I just did it in concert. I'm finding now a lot of conductors, when it's their big farewell, they want to do, you know, I've always wanted to do Turandot, let's do it in concert. Okay. And it can easily be done. So, you know, National Opera just did Das Rheingold, and they did, I mean, in the most beautiful, I think it's Belmont University, I think it's called. And it's, I'm still so geographically challenged as a Canadian. My gosh. I always say to my husband, where is that located again? You know, Kalamazoo is where? But Nashville, that's where we were, Nashville Opera, one of my favorite places. They did Das Rheingold, and I sang the role of Freya, which, you know, normally, you know, Brunhildes don't always sing Freyas, but, you know, thankfully, the casting, I mean, it was such luxury casting, it was amazing. Every single person was spectacular. And it was a lot of projections that were unbelievably incredible. You know, they had the bigger house, but they were able to do it without completely breaking the bank, you know, because John Holmes is incredible as a leader of the company, but also as a director. And you know, things can be done, but they should never not consider, this was a full stage production, so that was great, but opera companies should always know that opera in concert, even the dramatic operas like Electra, which I would love to do in concert, hint, 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 as I put that out into the universe, you know, it can be done very easily in concert and still be thrilling and exciting. I've never had someone, you know, hear me in concert in Turandot and say, oh, that was terrible, I didn't understand the story. You absolutely understood the story. And you know, when you say, you know, diversity matters, yes, that was a pledge that a lot of artistic directors and companies made, wasn't it?
Wasn't
I'm not
it?
Sure that. yes, and then you know, everyone, it's amazing to me. I have to tell you that, you know, as a Canadian, thrilled to be the first Canadian on the show, as a Canadian. you know, things here, I don't have the same historical the same history that is here. And when things happen here, as I've said in other interviews, I turn to my husband and I say, no way that can happen. You know, things that I just cannot believe. You know, we don't have the same gun culture in Canada, of course, mm-hmm. but, you know, whether it's the, you know, assassinating Black men, you know, as a mother and a mm-hmm. wife, I have a Black son, you know, it's all just very shocking. And then when George Floyd happened, you know, everyone, it's like they finally saw what was happening the entire time. You know, that was nothing new to us. It was just seen, and, you know, people reacted all over the world. Okay. Then all of these opera companies said, oh my, you know, we're going to commit, we're going to commit, we're going to commit. And then came out of it and did Poor Gambas.
Right. Right.
You know, that's not what we were asking for. That's not change. And that's not diversity. So, you know, we still have a long way to go. You know, you see there's a lot of companies. Again, I always hold them up, but like Nashville Opera, where John Holmes should be at Opera America leading the diversity discussion. How you know, there, people are hiring, you know, diversity officers. It's not that complicated. You need to hire Black singers and singers of color. Now, if you want to hire someone to help you get into, you know, other schools, to go to Spelman to find an opera singer, or, you know, find a way to get more Black singers and singers of color into your young artist program, okay, if you want to hire someone to help you do that, community outreach, that's one thing. But the problem is a lot of opera companies, they deal with certain, like, hey, we're going to deal with these 5 or 6 agents, and we're going to, you know, shuffle our singers around to these companies. And if you are not, if that agent doesn't have a Black singer, then it doesn't happen. And you know, so that's a thing. But there are companies, you know, where diversity was never an issue. Quite a few. There are quite a few where John Holmes, you know, I was in Arizona Opera singing Turandot, and he looked at me and we were doing some Turandot somewhere together. But anyway, wherever it was after Arizona. And he said to me, I want you to sing Minnie in Fanciulla. La Fanciulla del West, the girl of the Golden West, who is, you know, usually, you know, blonde and blue-eyed and beautiful and all of that. And I thought, okay. And I know that role as an opera singer, you know, that role is more Wagnerian than it. I mean, it's a big, 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 big sing. And yes, of course, it's perfectly written for me. It's high and big and all the stuff that I love. And he was absolutely right, but it took him to look at me, hear me sing, you know, Turandot, and say, oh, you should be singing this. That's what you should be singing. When I was at ABA, you know, what was I going to sing? There wasn't a lot of repertoire, you know, a full-scale opera that they can do with this dramatic, young dramatic soprano. So I did a lot of concerts. And then my last year, they did Elektra. I mean, Strauss's Elektra. I mean, who sings that? You know, I was still in school and singing Elektra. That does not happen. But it was so, you know, they brought in a lot of alums to sing the other roles. And, you know, the maids, the 5 maids in the beginning, you know, we're all ABA students, but it was such a perfect, it fit me and fits me like a glove. So when I was doing some auditions in Europe, and I went to the Teatro San Carlo in Napoli, And they said, oh, you sing Elektra? I said, oh, yes, yes, yes. So I, you know, did the big 20-minute opening monologue, my favorite, and ended up, you know, having to run over there and sing rehearsals for an indisposed soprano. So it's, you know, there are more companies that are more open to diversity. But it's really not that complicated. And I'm not sure why some places think it's so complicated that they have to, you know, listen, I'm not knocking someone who has that job. It's a great job, you know. How to diversify and let me go out into the community. That's different. Having someone go out into the community and, you know, get more people in the chorus or in the young artist program, or maybe offer vouchers for the audition fees for young artist programs that maybe not everyone can afford, things like that. But it's really as simple as looking for other artists. I mean, you know, we're out here. And hiring more singers of color or more Black singers. Seems pretty simple to me. I don't know. You don't have to mount the whole Black opera.
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth. The work isn't complicated. One just has to commit and actually do it, right? And I mean, I think have to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, people, you know, went through all of this stuff and put up Black squares and we support, when we know as a community that you have never hired a Black singer, especially some of those places, in one or two I'm thinking of that are summer places, where you have never, you've had Black young artists, but you've never had Black leading singers. Main stage, whether it's tenors, sopranos, baritones, whatever, basses. And, you know, you went through all of that to, because I know it was the thing to do on social media and it, you know, looked good and all of that. And then, you know, but that's not it. That is not it. It's, yes, diversity officers and all of that. Yes, it's very important because you're holding a company's, holding them accountable on a daily basis. But it should not even be a consideration. You know, some people were saying, oh, yes, well, we just want the best singer for the job. Absolutely. But how do you find out about those singers that aren't necessarily being cast? You know, if you're singing at, you know, this opera house, a well-known opera house, then immediately you're hired to sing at these four or five other ones. If you're not, then you're not. And that's where, you know, certain things are closed off to certain people.
Yeah, you know, speaking as a diversity officer, we do what we can.
You do such important work. I might be doing that job someday in my life. It's such important work, but it should never have had to happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's especially in the arts. And I know that I have colleagues who do that important work, and it just, you know, they're like banging their heads against the wall going, what don't you understand? You know, because there's boards. I know. There, you know, between boards and all of that other stuff, you know, it's just, and I've, as a singer, I know for certain, many of us have had, you know, encountered, you know, board members who say the craziest things that should never, ever, ever be uttered. And, you know, and you bite your tongue until blood is pouring down your chin and pooling on your breast so that you know, don't lose their, you know, $100,000 donation and sip your wine and run away. You know, it's just, oh, it's difficult. It is difficult. And the job you do is very difficult. I can't even imagine. Honestly, I can't imagine.
Well, you know, I find that, yes, there are frustrating times and there are those times that you sort of have to bite your tongue. But I find that, you know, when it does work and, you know, you are seeing more Black faces, Brown faces, Asian faces in the building, up on the stage, in the audiences, that's when it's like, oh, wow, okay.
Yes.
Cool. This actually can work. All right. You're like,
look at what we're doing. Look at what we're doing. Because yeah. Because then you get what some of us have had, like you and I talked about. You are that kid sitting in the seat, seeing someone who looks like you do something that you never thought was even possible for you, or you didn't know anything about. And that's why it's so important.
Yeah, because I remember a few years ago, I was participating in a conference, and on the last day of the conference, it just sort of like hit me like a speeding train, just sort of like all of the work that still needed to be done. Because I'm sitting in this room full of all of these like very well-intentioned, well-meaning folks, and like they're still just saying like disappointing things, and it's still just like,
oh yes, oh,
so
yes.
Crazy and so frustrating. Yes. But this other woman, who she saw me from across the room, and we had connected during this conference, another Black woman who's doing the same work here in the Twin Cities, Sina Hodges, shout out to Sina. She saw me sort of like looking out into the middle distance, and she comes over and she gives me a hug, and she's like, we're going to go back to the Twin Cities and we're going to do this together, and you're going to see that there's going to be so much joy.
Oh,
and that's what I've sort of been approaching all of this work for the last few years with, is that like ultimately like we're working on creating more joy for more people more of the time. And part of that means that you have to like get through, wade through some BS, some stuff that makes you crazy, some stuff that people that are putting up obstacles. But if you can get through that, then you get to the joy. That's what I'm hoping.
that's the way we all have to look at all of this, because if not, you know, you're just mired in negativity and just not sure how to move forward. Good for you. That's because I thank you for being on the front lines of that, because but thank you for being on the front lines of some of those discussions, because I know for certain that, you know, a lot of that is just not easy and can be pretty shocking. Some of those discussions are pretty shocking. That's true. It's like, what did you say?
Well, the progress has been slow, but you know, it does feel like things are trending in the right direction, at least in the sense that 5 years ago, I don't know that this configuration of human beings would have been platformed to have this kind of a conversation on any opera company's professional space, right? So I do look at that as being a really positive thing. And, you know, I take a lot of the points that have come today as a reminder that a lot of the complications that we face in classical music are self-imposed, right? And are easier to remove than people act as if they are. And I think that it's so important to have these conversations and this continued bit of education around, we can kind of cut through the noise about why the representation is off, who is missing from conversations, and then the question that seems to mystify so many people, why are we not in the audiences at a representative number? And it's because we are not on stage in representative numbers, we are not in the offices in representative numbers, we are not creating the work in representative numbers. And if we can get more people to understand that that's what the issue is, it will address a lot of these audience challenges that so many people seem to be stymied by.
Amen, 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 and a double amen. Because I know, that's it. That is you need to write that down and send it to every company, because, you know, that is absolutely it. And what's incredible is we have so much buying power, and companies are just not understanding and not tapping into that. And when I'm, you know, if I'm singing a Turandot or something, and I'm on, you know, in their social media or on the front page of a page, people who have never come to the opera will come. And I will walk out afterward and see, you know, more of us, whether it's at a reception or, you know, backstage at the stage door waiting. And, you know, we want to support our artists. And that person that was so excited by me that invited, you know, 10 of their other friends to the next performance will then say, oh, well, I could, you know, is there going to be more of this? I will support this opera company, you know, because my company, you know, my million-dollar company could certainly, you know, support. I could take ads out in the program. I can, you know, there's so much. We have so
absolutely
much. We have so much buying power, and we put it towards what we want to support. But if we're not represented, why would we?
Right.
Exactly. My generation does that increasingly, like in younger millennials and certainly Gen Z, they go off values, and it can be like frustrating to see people not get that. Like,
right.
we don't go to see just anything. I mean, I think a perfect direct example of what you're just talking about, this happened just the other night. Some friends of mine, you know, we were hanging out and we were like, yeah, well, what's everyone doing next? What else you got going on for the day? And they said, oh, we're going to the orchestra. And I was like, huh, what do you say with the orchestra? Because I didn't know them to be people who go to the orchestra regularly. That's there's right. usually yes. other arts yes. they engage in. And you know what a simple answer was? Oh, there's this cool program featuring an indigenous, and the friend is indigenous, and that was it.
that was
what got That's them. It. It was that simple. Yeah.
That is it. That is it. And that's what, especially that generation. Hey, look, guys, I just saw that so-and-so, you know, this artist is singing. I don't know anything about this music, but we're going to go and support. You know, it's like when they told us, our generation, I don't know who's in my generation, but you know, that magazines with black people on the cover don't sell. The minute I heard that, every single time any magazine, you know, that is not one of ours puts a black person on it, I will race to anywhere I can get magazines and buy two or three and hand them out. Because I mean, whatever little thing, you know, it's like Kerry Washington, you know, buying out theaters for you know, Woman King. We have to do whatever, and we do. That's what we do. We support each other, even if we don't know each other, even if it's not something we've ever seen before, even if it's not something we know. We support. I have supported things where I can't even physically go, but I will buy tickets.
Absolutely.
And, you know, leave them at will call for whomever. You know, if they say, oh, we've got two extra tickets, great. But I want to support with my dollars, because I know how important that is.
Well, speaking of support, I'm looking at the clock and I'm seeing that we're getting close to our time together. So how can people support you? You know, where can people follow you, and what are some of the performances that you've got coming up that people can go see?
Well, I have the Portland Opera coming up. There's actually many singers of color in that cast. I'm the foreign princess in Rusalka. I've been working on my Czech language. just definitely not the easiest one. I mean, and it's funny because it's a role that I've wanted to sing. You know, it's not a leading role. It is a leading-ish role, but it's not the title character. But it's a role that I've wanted to sing for such a long time. You know, a mysterious foreign princess sort of thing. But the tenor who is playing the prince is spectacular, a spectacular tenor, Limmy, who I'm sure a lot of people have heard about already. So it'll be great to share the stage with him. And then, as you mentioned in the beginning, I've got the Harrisburg Symphony right after that. I've been doing a lot of symphony concerts with just, you know, myself and the orchestra, which is wonderful. But it's my first time doing the Ravel Scheherazade. And then, you know, having the honor, as I look at it, to sing Isolde's Liebestod again, because it's just my favorite music. And then, of course, I'm always, you know, on social media, cooking and familying and, you know, trying to do it all and have it all, just not all at the same time, as my mother would always say.
Oh, that is very exciting. We're very excited for you. We have friends of the show in Portland. Please give our best to Preethi and Damian Jeter. And we are so grateful that we were able to have you on this morning. This has been a really beautiful conversation. And I'm glad that we finally got to chat. I've only been hearing about you for like 15 years. So it was so nice to connect finally.
Thank you. I was saying the same thing. I finally get to even physically, you know, look at your face at least on the screen after all of these years. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we will be back right after this.
We are back. What fantastic conversation that was. She's so cool. Love her.
Cool. That was fun.
We should have more Jamaicans on the show. That's my vote.
I'm down for that. I like y'all.
I'm fine with
I
that.
I like y'all. We have a good track record with y'all.
Mm-hmm. Well, now it is time for the last segment of the show, which is also our favorite. Are we ready?
Ready.
And a one, and a two, and a one, two, three, go.
It's peanut butter jelly time, peanut butter jelly time, peanut butter jelly time, peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly with a baseball bat, peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly, peanut butter jelly with a baseball bat.
Yes! That's right. It is time for Pure Black Joy, PB&J, a little snack for your soul. And this is where we highlight the Black people, places, ideas, things that are bringing us joy this week. And so I think we'll keep it short because I know it's been a long episode. But Lee, do you have one to share?
I do. I have three, and I'll keep them each to one sentence.
Okay.
First Black woman getting a Broadway theater named after her, Lena Horne. Yes. I'm super excited about that. Don't know what took y'all so long, but finally. Secondly, Rihanna has new music out. I've been waiting patiently. She's singing the theme from the new Black Panther, and it's great. Buy you a copy. Don't bootleg it. Let Rihanna get her money. And thirdly, one of my favorite New York actors, Baron A. Myers, is on this season's American Horror Story, which I haven't watched in a while, but I will tune in for that. For those of you in the know, Baron once played me in an off-Broadway show, and I have been a fan since then. Literally.
Dr. Lee me. Bynum.
Yes.
Huh.
Okay. That's what I said. He did a great job.
I hope it was flattering.
It was a delightful performance. So congratulations, Baron. And I will be tuning in. Hope you don't get your head cut off or anything like that. But you probably will because it's American Horror Story.
Yeah.
That's true.
I have not watched that show since Coven.
Same.
Yeah. Which was good. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
It was for Angela Bassett mainly. I'm not even gonna lie. So
ding ding.
When you have an Angela Bassett like bigger again, that's probably when I'll get into it. Mm-hmm.
Well, you actually stole my Pure Black Joy.
Oh,
we should have consulted before. No, it's okay.
I did think of one.
We've been talking, you know, so much about, you know, Jamaicans this episode, and you know, I feel as though like our Jamaican friends, our Trini friends, our Bahamian friends, you know, you all get a lot of deserved shine, but you know, we just need to pour one out today for the Bajans, you know. Yay. Usually yes. We are just known for our stunning good looks and common sense. which is more than enough. But every now and again, one of us, you know that I saw a tweet the other day that was like, you know, having children is expensive, like when Rihanna goes back to work. And Rihanna is back to work, as Asian cousin. So proud, so excited. Now, is this new song my particular cup of tea? But I'm just excited that she's back, and I know that there are going to be amazing things to come. I'm so excited to see her at the Super Bowl. I will actually be sitting down and watching the Super Bowl with my popcorn, much like Beyonce those past couple of times that she did it, because I know that it's going to be everything. And shout out to Rihanna and her beautiful family and her wonderful music and her beautiful spirit. And shout out to them.
Shout out to the Bayesian queen.
Yes.
I realize my pure black joy is everyone's pictures of HBCU homecomings.
Yes.
And videos. That's my pure black joy. It would have been it's 10 years since my first HBCU homecoming. Oh, wow. At Howard University in 2012, which also happened to be an iconic year because Drake showed up by surprise to our homecoming concert, to our Yard Fest. Howard Yard Fest is already a big deal. There's been all kinds of people who has been all over the years, but that's when Drake showed up by surprise in a Howard sweatshirt. He came running on stage while 2 Chainz was performing. It was lit. Y'all don't understand. It was so lit. T.I. showed up. Was that by surprise too? And it started downpouring while he comes out to singing, bring him out, bring him out. It was iconic. It was iconic. I need you to understand. So I truly wanted to be there to commemorate the experience. And just, if you've never been to a homecoming at a historically black college or university, that's what HBCU stands for. It is a big old family reunion. It is people of all ages, from all parts of the world. I was gonna say the country, but the world, because people come to HBCUs from all over the world, truly. So I've just been getting a lot of joy watching beautiful black people gathering via social media. It looks, because of my situation right now and still having gone through a year of spiritual transformation and all that and new priesthood and all that, it looks a little bit like sensory overload for me. It looks a little overstimulating to me, but I love watching y'all have fun from afar and celebrating the legacy of HBCUs. And I know people have been waiting to gather since the pandemic and just like continue that tradition. So yeah, that's my pure black joy. HBCU homecomings. Shout out to all y'all, every HBCU. Howard especially, you know, but every HBCU, truly, I love all of y'all. Mm-hmm.
And I will say those pictures floating around Twitter of Angelina Jolie standing next to the portraits of Lil Uzi and Drake and whatnot just took me out. Took me right out.
Shout out to her. Believe in.
Shout out to her supporting her daughter. That's a beautiful thing.
Right. funny because it is the pictures that like every parent, like Black parents be taking and stuff when you're dropping your kids off at an HBC. It's just so funny to see Angelina Jolie doing it. Like...
Well, I think that's going to do it for us this episode. This has been so much fun. Thank you both.
Yes.
And thank you to Off on the Gram for joining us. And thank you to all of you for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you heard, please go and leave us a 5-star review. 5 stars.
Por favor.
And of course, some words also help with that as well. And subscribe on your favorite podcast app of choice and tell all your friends about us if somebody needs some pure Black joy in their life. Send them our direction. So I think that's it. I don't think I missed anything. Any words of wisdom?
Vote.
That's the word of wisdom. Vote, please. Because, I have a feeling our next episode is... okay, so let's go get mentally prepared for that. and we'll see you next time. All right, bye, everybody. Love you.
Bye-bye.
America and India.